98, Falana versus Kent State University. Mr. Galem, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. Our position is that the district court, in starting its inventorship analysis, which begins with the claims, misconstrued the claims by not limiting them to an optically active compound having a substantially temperature-independent helical twist power, or HTP.
Let me just ask you a logistical question, if you don't mind, just to start off. If we were to disagree with you hypothetically on that claim construction revision that you're proposing to what the district court did, does that end this case, or are there still any other arguments you have with respect to co-inventorship?
It does not end the case. I mean, first of all, from just looking at the claim itself, it requires an RR enantiomer. That is an express limitation in the claim. What the district court found, and what Dr. Falana was arguing, was that the compound 7, which he synthesized, was the basis for, was one of two bases for finding he was a co-inventor. But that compound, it's undisputed, is of the SS enantiomer. So initially, it doesn't even meet the express limitations of the claims. Inventorship is done on a claim-by-claim basis, looking at the properly construed claims and comparing them to the alleged contribution. So right off the bat, it doesn't meet the express limitations of the claim. Now, the other part to the inventorship issue was the synthesis protocol. And the district court relied on this synthesis protocol, this method of synthesizing compound 7 and eventually compound 9 as contributing to inventorship. But that's really legally irrelevant because there were no method claims in the patent at all. And the synthesis protocol is clearly a method of synthesizing the compounds.
But it's the method that produces the compound that's claimed.
It is.
Don't you need, for conception of a compound, don't you need to know both what the compound is and how to make it?
You do. And Dr. Falana never knew the compound. He had a synthesis protocol, which the district court, for one thing, never found that that was new or novel. And that was one of the things that we contended, was that the chemistry is old. There was nothing.
But if the method, the synthesis protocol, was a contributing factor to the compound that is claimed, then isn't that properly considered as part of the conception?
No, not here, because the chemistry, the synthesis protocol, was old. It's what a person of ordinary skill in the art would understand. And simply bringing that level, that understanding.
Was there a finding that that synthesis protocol was old? I thought the finding was that this was a new protocol, that this was a discovery of Dr. Falana.
I didn't read anything in the court's opinion that said that it was new or that it was discovered by Dr. Falana. It was in his lab notebooks. It was the protocol that ended up described in the 789 patent. But I don't see any citation in the court's decision that said it was new, novel, or that he discovered it.
Wasn't that the basis for the conclusion of inventorship?
It was in part of it. But that's the point. The court never found that it was new. The court just said, well, Dr. Falana had the synthesis protocol in his notebooks. It ended up in the patent. That's how the compounds were synthesized. But I can't find any holding that says that it is, in fact, novel and that it was new to him.
Okay, I'm looking on page, this is A10, which is actually also page 10 of the opinion. And it says that on March or April 99, Falana utilized the synthesis protocol to make a novel compound in the course of his work. So apparently the court found that the synthesis protocol did go to the development of a novel compound, which led on to the development of would be compound 9.
Well, the compound that the district court's referring to on A10, that is compound 7. And compound 7 was for one thing, it was the SS enantiomer, so it didn't meet the express limitation of the claim. And if you accept our claim construction argument, then it also was not, didn't exhibit temperature-independent helical twist power. But here, even this, it doesn't say that the synthesis protocol was new or novel. It says it was used to synthesize or make a novel compound, compound 7. Compound 7 isn't what is claimed. So I don't think that paragraph says that the synthesis protocol is new or novel.
He developed the synthesis protocol, and as I read this finding, developed the synthesis protocol for making not previously known naphthol substituted TADDOLS or TADOLS.
Well,
and that's the technique that was used both to make compound 7 and compound 9. Isn't that right?
It is correct. But the testimony was also from Dr. Seed that technology was old. And in fact, that's where the district court, we contend, also erred in excluding two references, both a UK patent that predated all of this and an article that Dr. Seed had published, again predating all of this, that described those.
Didn't find that evidence credible and didn't permit it, didn't enter it.
Well, Your Honor, the district court didn't make any findings as to the weight of those references. The district court simply excluded them, and as best we can tell from the record, based on relevance. But even that's not clear. Dr. Falana's counsel didn't state a reason for the objection. The court asked, how is it relevant, and then excluded them completely.
Right, but there was certainly no finding that those that whatever it is that's contained in those documents was in fact correct.
Well, that's why
they were excluded.
Well, there was no finding about the documents at all. I mean, really, if the court had wanted to say that the documents were incorrect, that would really go towards their weight.
Now, I know you're objecting to, or you object to the fact that they were excluded, but on this record, it seems to me that what the district court found was that Dr. Falana did develop this synthesis protocol, and it was something new.
Again, I didn't read it that way. He developed it, but he used old chemistry to get there, and
that's what you're arguing, but I don't think that's what he found.
Okay. Well, again, I would then go back, and still my initial point was there's no method claims here. And in looking at some of the precedent, including American, I believe it's Bioscience, we're only talking about compound claims, apparatus claims. And Dr. Falana wasn't even around when compound 9 was synthesized, which was the only time that the parties thought that they had finally solved the problem and applied for a patent.
If we go back to that same page we've been talking about on the court's opinion, it says a synthesis protocol is reflected in columns 7 and 8 of the 789 patent as a method by which the claimed compounds were synthesized. So apparently the court found that the synthesis protocol was a method, and it's apparently the only method disclosed for making the claimed compounds.
That's correct. That's the method that is in the patent, and for synthesizing the compound 9 as well as compound 7, which didn't meet the limitations. Again, I don't think this is saying that the synthesis protocol is new or novel, just that it's what was used to get there. And the district court also talked at great lengths about how this was a shotgun approach. I mean, these were looking for different compounds that would meet the goals of the project, the temperature-independent helical twist power. This wasn't new chemistry. And it wasn't until 6 months after Dr. Flana had left that a successful compound was synthesized. Again, folding back to the apparatus claims and the nature of those claims.
What standard of review do we apply here to what the district court did? I know claim construction, obviously, that comes into it, and that's de novo, right?
So correct.
A question of law. But this case was based on an extensive record, correct?
That's correct.
About what happened to the invention, how it was created, how it went. Isn't there a considerable amount of deference owed to the district court judge with respect to all of the questions involved in co-inventorship?
Well, inventorship is a question of law, and there's de novo review of that. But the underlying findings are reviewed for clear error.
So all of the questions we've been talking about here, or at least the main things that you challenge with respect to what led to the district court's ultimate conclusion, those are all fact findings that we would be reviewing here for clear error, correct?
Well, that's correct. But other than the issue, there aren't that many factual issues in dispute here other than the synthesis protocol being new, and that's where we fold back into the exclusion of those prior art references was harmful error and was an abuse of discretion, because those references, which really there's no way to dispute them, they all predated this, it's our contention, would have shown that the synthesis protocol was old. But the district court didn't make any findings. The court just excluded those without any findings as to the references. And then he did allow Dr. Seed to testify about them, but then he said his testimony wasn't credible and didn't give it any weight. By excluding
is his right to do. That's what his job is as a district court judge, right?
Yes, but by doing that, he took away any defense we had at all, because those references would have corroborated Dr. Seed's testimony. And it's not even clear why he excluded them, other than we think relevance, but the standard there is extremely low. If he wanted to, he should have let them in, and we could have looked at the weight of those. But that
well,
was
right. The standard there is extremely low, but the standard that we apply as a court of appeals to that determination by the district court judge is quite high, is it not?
It is, but there's just nothing there to base this on. He doesn't say why he excluded it at all. There's no consideration in the record for why, except he asked, why is it relevant, and then just said, they're excluded. I see I'm in my rebuttal time.
Yeah, you want to reserve that time?
I do.
All right, very good. Mr. Wilson.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you. May it please the court. I must say that I'm a little put off by the large passive audience behind me. I wish they could now whisper to me what their questions were about all this, but
they're cheering you on, I'm sure.
Well,
can I just step back a minute?
Yes.
Just to what's at play here. Your client now has prevailed as a co-inventor. In order to prevail as a co-inventor, essentially it's being based on a claim construction that's quite narrow, that I think there's some suggestion is that it makes the patent itself worthless. Is that true necessarily? I don't know, this probably isn't a matter of record, but I think people have argued that under this narrow claim construction, which you're here advocating that we adopt, there's very little left to the breadth of this claim. And if so, why are we here in the first place? I mean, who wants to be, you know, we're fighting about co-inventorship on a worthless patent? That can't be what we're doing here, right?
Well, worthless to whom? I mean, my client does not feel the patent is worthless. But let me address your concerns. First, as to the claim construction, the dispute between Seed and Falana, and I'm going to just limit it. They were both doctors. We call them Dr. Seed, Dr. Falana, but let's leave it at Seed and Falana. Sort of really grew out of proportion to the record when we actually tried this case. My high watermark was when the other two named inventors basically stopped disputing that Dr. Falana made a material contribution to the invention as claimed. Now, I take your point very seriously, as does Falana, that once Dr. Seed decided that if he couldn't exclude Falana, he decided he would put a match to the whole thing by resorting to references of his that date back as far as apparently 1991, these disputed references, which he tries to bring in at the last moment to pretend as though he could not and did not learn a thing from his colleague. Now, first of all, there wasn't much of a proffer of these references. The district court, to be sure, didn't have much chance to examine them in the detail we now offer you about what they may or may not portend. But Seed actually puts a limit on the importance of those references himself if you read his testimony in the record when he's asked about the references. He's resorting to a patent he did in the UK in 1991. That is 10-plus years before the patent in question. The patent wasn't offered to the patent office as a reference, which, again, comes back to, I think, the point you're raising that is a great concern to us. If it was a material reference that anticipated under 102 or 103, why didn't the patent office get it? I'm not concerned, having looked at it, that they might get it now, but I think it's a bit of a cheap shot. Now, why is he doing that? Well, for some reason, Dr. Seed, and I can conjecture as to what that reason might be, but let's just deal with it this way. He would not, will not accept that Falana became everybody's teacher in this instance. Falana comes to work in 1998. One of the first jobs he gets as the new chemist on the block is to go to the DARPA review where the money's coming from to explain to the government what they're doing. The three objectives here of high twisting power, solubility, and temperature independence are replete in the very first reports that Falana presents to the DARPA people in June of 1998. He conceived at that point, beyond question, what the invention was that the other three were working on, that he was hired to help them finish. We then proceed to April of the next year. Seed is nowhere to be found. Falana and Kahn are doing this work primarily. Falana does the work of synthesis. Kahn does the measurements, reports the results. In April, he finally finds a very desirable compound. Kahn and Falana are terribly excited about it. They point it out, and wouldn't you know, in that particular month, Dr. Doan comes on board, and he's so anxious to keep Falana that he writes this infamous letter to the Immigration and Nationalization Service that says, we have got patentable subject matter because of Dr. Falana. So we're all on our way. At
There's
that point,
there's a disconnect between compound 7 and compound 9.
The difference is apparently the degree of temperature independence over a particular range. Both compounds exhibit temperature independence. That was the key step in reaching the objectives of the project and finding something that was worth patenting. The material contribution, we can argue about whether or not compound 7 fits comfortably within claim 1 or claim 25 by messing around talking about RR and SS enantiomers, which are simply the direction which something twists and aren't really that important, frankly, to what's claimed.
Well, isn't the direction of twist quite important. That doesn't, don't the different enantiomers, the right-handed, left-handed, often have dramatically different properties?
They can, but not with the objective in mind for this particular invention. What the inventors wanted in the end, which is why I argue vigorously that they had no intention of importing limitations from the specification about temperature independence, or except maybe in one instance importing a limitation about the twist sense, is that they wanted this entire class of compounds. Why? Because Phalana had taught them they could manipulate them. They could put them in different pneumatic hosts. They could keep on improving on what they already had. They didn't choose to limit themselves. They could have, but they chose not to limit themselves to a specific RRSS enantiomer in all the claims, arguably in one. But if that doesn't get actual invention for Phalana, as in claim 25, then he certainly made a material contribution. That's the bedrock here.
Was the synthesis protocol novel?
It was indeed, Your Honor, and I, for as much as Judge Dowd and Mr. Gaum and I, in all humility, I won't speak, how can I speak for the judge, but for Mr. Gaum and I, we did not make that determination. It's not seriously disputed, but I'll tell you what, there's another author for that, and it's the examiner in the PCT application. He finds, if you look at, I think it's A1985, he finds in the initial review of the application that naphthol-substituted tadols were not known in the art. Well, that's exactly what Phalana taught everybody to synthesize. He came with the brains to do it. He had the tenacity to do it. He had the good fortune to have a colleague who helped measure compound by compound what he did, and they recognized and convinced the other two, Dr. Doan and Dr. Seed, that they had indeed achieved the objectives of the funded research and had something worth patenting. What is disturbing is that for reasons probably not proven in the record, these three people, even today, are determined not to give credit where credit is due. And, of course, that's why I take this extremely seriously, and I don't like the idea. I don't like the idea that for as much as the references that were excluded are frankly not material to patentability, they're nevertheless being proffered as though they might be, as though they might cast a shadow over all this. So
there's various instances in the record where witnesses retracted statements or they qualified their statements, like the statement you said a while ago about the immigration and reporting to the authorities that Phalana was the inventor and comes back and says, well, I only did that for the immigration purposes. Given all of this, how can we say that the district court abused its discretion in awarding attorney's fees?
Well, I'm not going to stand for that proposition, but I also don't think it's ripe for argument. I think we have a record which is sort of stalled at the point where Judge Dowd realized this appeal was ongoing, that clearly if you decide that he was wrong, the issue of attorney's fees simply evaporates. And frankly, when I'm reminded of the record we have made of what the amount of work that has gone into this case is very disproportionate, Your Honor, with what others may think the patent is worth. But isn't that so in a lot of litigation? We got stuck in our ways.
That's probably very true.
So,
but I'm not sure you've addressed Judge Reyna's question.
I'll try again, if I may try again. Your point, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
Your question, I'm sorry.
You want me to repeat it?
I okay. Must have gotten too excited.
So giving the various witnesses untruthfulness, as
yes.
the judge noted, then how can we say that the district court abused its discretion in awarding the attorney's fees? Or how would you argue? What's your position on that?
Well, my position is that he did not. I do think Mr. Gaum has a point that neither he nor I, frankly, had a chance to present our best arguments. I think mine, I can say, are well contained within what the judge did. I could not have written more positively for my side of the argument that this conduct warrants a sanction of that kind, but I'll grant that Mr. Gomb didn't have that chance until the judge set the pace for awarding fees. He ordered me to submit an application, which is quite extensive. He made an order, which is general in its statement, that Mr. Gomb could reply. Mr. Gomb and his colleagues had the opportunity at that point, I think the judge gave it to him, to come back and argue what you're asking about, argue that what he did was an abuse of his discretion. They chose not to do that. They made their argument here instead. Now, I have not taken great pains to meet the argument because I think the Wedgetail case says there's nothing to review at this point until we finish that process, until everybody gets a chance to be heard on the issue. I think my argument will be much like what the judge has already written. Why would I change it? Those are the very points I would have made. Now, there's two.
Your position is that your client should be a named co-inventor.
Yes,
because
sir.
He contributed to the conception of the process, the synthesis protocol. And at the same time, you seem to be defending the district court's action of awarding attorney's fees, and part of that was based on inequitable conduct. Are you suggesting that your client should be named a co-inventor to a patent that is unenforceable because of inequitable conduct?
No, Your Honor, I'm not stretching it that far. I simply was taking the suggestion from Judge Prost that that cloud is out there and someone at some time who wishes to attack the validity of the patent already has a sort of a pattern set to do it. But no,
that,
I don't.
That cloud is important to the award of attorney's fees.
Indeed it is. But I say.
You don't want that cloud to necessarily go away.
That's correct. But I do not.
Hang in there enough to hold on to those fees.
Well, it would be nice to do that. I take that, however, as my secondary objective. My primary objective is to stand for the inventor and proudly accept what he's accomplished so far, which is to get a very hardworking district court judge to take the time to review a rather difficult history of events and to come to grips with misbehavior, which didn't help at all getting to the real essence of the case, which is, was there an invention? Was there a material contribution to that invention? And coming to an understanding of what it was. That was tough enough to do. Now, with the noise in the system about people being for Falana and against Falana, that it did not help. Was Dr. Doan, for example, an expert? Was he proffered as an expert on the materiality of these belated references? No, he wasn't. He isn't. He wasn't. Was Dr. Kahn proffered as a witness for that? No. Who was Dr. Seed? Dr. Seed was making it up, is what it appeared to be, as a last-ditch effort to get the court to weigh evidence which has no materiality at all. Seed admits himself that if it stood for anything, if this old work stood for anything, it stood for his perhaps making the very first step in the synthesis protocol, which I hope wouldn't totally anticipate, in the long run, the claims that were allowed. The other very disturbing thing, I'm sure, for the court is that Falana prepared carefully his notebooks, kept them pristine. He gave them to Seed because Seed demanded them when he left. What does Seed do to write himself in all of this exercise? He puts dates in the books which guarantee, if you believe them, that he never saw the invention emerge. The dates predate compound 7. And yet he will also admit, on the other hand, he used the synthesis to make his compound 9. What is with that? I'm sorry, but that's what I think energized the court to move on without our help to look at the question of attorney's fees.
All right. We thank you very much, Mr. Gowan. We've got a few minutes for rebuttal.
Well, Your Honor, first of all, this notion that everyone was against Dr. Falana is simply false. Although he's not listed on the patent as an inventor for the reasons we've briefed, he was included in an article. He even left. I mean, he is on a published article about these compounds. Nobody at the university or at KDI was out to keep any credit from him. So this notion that everybody was out to get him is simply false. And plus, there's no motivation. I mean, Dr. Seed, what's his motivation? His rights belong to the university. He doesn't have any rights in the patent. I mean, so all this plot against Dr. Falana is simply just false. As far as district court abusing its discretion in awarding fees, one of the biggest problems was that the district court lumped the testimony of my clients, but also of the non-party individuals, Drs. Doan and Kahn. They weren't represented or part of the university. They were called by Dr. Falana. They were non-parties by that point. But the district court repeatedly lumps everybody together and then sanctions KSU and Dr. Seed. That's an abuse of discretion. If you're going to sanction someone, you need to be specific as to what their sanctionable conduct is. And repeatedly, the district court goes back to this INS letter, but that was by Dr. Doan. That wasn't by anyone at KSU or Dr. Seed. So that's the abuse of discretion right there. There simply was no inequitable conduct. I don't even know where that issue came from. It wasn't litigated. Nobody argued it. It just showed up in the findings later, and even
but
there
it's... But do you assume that it was not the term of art that we all know in patent law of inequitable conduct, that it was just a description of the conduct of the parties which he found improper or egregious? Is that what you assume?
I didn't assume that. Maybe that's what the district court meant. Maybe I'm just so patent-focused that when I see inequitable conduct, I go, holy smokes, what are we talking about here?
So in your view, what is this cloud... composed of this, the attorney's fees decision, what does that do to the value of the patent?
Well, I don't know that the attorney fee issue does anything to the value of the patent. I mean, the patent itself does not have much monetary value at this point. I mean, KSU and KDI, they thought it did at the time. They thought it was revolutionary technology, and that's why they went forward. But like many things, the technology kept advancing, and today it's not worth that much. And I don't know all the ins and outs of the improvements, but that was basically the testimony that at the time it was, but now it's not really.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank both counsel for their arguments, and that concludes our argument session today.